Good evening, everyone. Let's do it that way. It's a pleasure to see all of you here. I'm Josie Parker. I'm the director at the Ann Arbor District Library, and thank you. The first thing I'll do is ask you to silence any devices that you might have brought with you, and also to let you know that if you have not purchased Ms. Stahl's books or book, they are for sale in the lobby, and there will be a signing after she speaks this evening. It's always such a great pleasure to represent the district library at the Michigan Theater as a partner with Michigan Radio. And it's really only in Ann Arbor, I think, where we can bring the quality of speaker to our community. And it's through this joint effort and all these resources that we bring to bear on it. And I want to thank the Michigan Theater and all the people working here this evening and Michigan Radio and all that they bring to the community. When we first learned that Leslie Stahl was coming and what she was going to speak about, I have been such a foolish, giddy new grandmother that people at the library weren't really sure they should tell me because it was going to be such a long time before tonight. But I have consoled myself with visits with my Miss Evelyn of Northern Virginia. And she and her Jojo, as she calls me, have great moments together. And I am pretty certain that most of you in this room know what I'm talking about and look very much forward to hearing how Leslie talks to us tonight about the new grandparenting and what that means and how we can be great grandparents to all children, not only those that are the ones who are born to us. And it's my pleasure this evening to introduce Vincent Duffy, who's the news editor of the Michigan Radio, and he will introduce Ms. Stahl. Thank you all for being here.
Well, good evening, everybody. As Josie said, my name is Vincent Duffy. I'm the news director at Michigan Radio. We're the NPR station here in Ann Arbor, and you can hear us at 91.7. Michigan Radio is proud to be a co-sponsor of tonight's event with Leslie Stahl as she discusses her book, Becoming Grandma, The Joys and Science of the New Grandparenting. I am not yet a grandparent. I do hope to be one in the future, but not too soon. My oldest is 19, so it will be coming sometime, maybe in about 10 years or so. Leslie Stahl, easily recognized from her 25 years as a correspondent on CBS at 60 Minutes, and she had many years of outstanding journalism as well before that. She's received numerous awards for all of that hard work, including last year the Paul White Award for a Lifetime Achievement from the Radio, Television, Digital News Association. But she says that interviewing heads of state and covering the White House and doing those types of stories did not have the effect on her that came with becoming a grandmother. So she put her journalism skills to use and investigated being a grandmother. And the result is the book that she's going to tell us about tonight. So please join me in welcoming Leslie Stahl.
Wow, look at you. Oh, man, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I can't really see you. The lights are right in my eyes. But before I start, I have to ask you, how many of you are grandparents? My people, all right. A majority, right? Yes. So, someone asked me the other day if I knew who was watching, who watches 60 Minutes. And I said, who? And they said, old people and their parents. I had a friend warn me when I said I was going to write a book about being a grandmother, warned me not to do it, said it was foolish to tell people you're that old. So when I started to write, with that in my mind, I did it with great trepidation. But the more I explored, the more I researched, and the more I got into it, the more courage I had, especially when I found out that Mick Jagger is a great grandfather. That then everything was fine. I eventually came to see that when we're grandparents, we don't get older, we get younger. I mean, it makes us younger, it makes us healthier. I found that there are actually studies that say that taking care of grandchildren fends off dementia, can lift depression, it makes us healthier generally, and it certainly makes us happier. No question about that. So what's happening today in our country is that the baby boomers are becoming grandparents. As we know, the baby boomers as they have marched through their lives, have completely affected every stage as they've gone through. They've changed our culture. The baby boomers have changed our attitudes. They have determined how we dress, what music we listen to. And their holy grail is staying and looking young. So today, grannies don't have tightly permed gray hair. We are all blonde. And we're going to the gym 3 and 4 days a week. So we're looking pretty good, pretty cool dudes. And since boomers have been able to talk, they have had the most important thing to them was this youth culture, this youth, the sense that being young was the most important thing. So as grandparents, that's how we are. What is amazing is that now we have a whole new phase of life in front of us, baby boomers and all grandparents. We are going to live another 30 years after we retire. This is a whole new opening up that has no plan. I met a woman who is the head of the School of Public Health at Columbia University. And she said, I like to say life is divided 30, 30, and 30. So the first 30 years are for education. The second 30 years are for earning money and having a family. And then the last 30 years, what? We don't have a plan, because people haven't lived that long. Well, what I'm saying in my book and saying to you is that the best way to spend that extra bonus time that our generation is now going to have is not sitting home watching television and being bored. The best way is to get involved with your grandchildren. And many, many are. There's this whole trend now in the country where grandparents, once they retire, are moving out of the homes and houses they've lived in for 50 years, and they're moving across the country or wherever to be near their grandchildren, to be in their grandchildren's lives. And what I say is that those grandparents who are taking care of their grandchildren 1, 2, 3 days a week, they're granny nannies. And it is the newest trend. Now, if you go back to caveman times and take humanity all the way up to the Industrial Revolution, the way we were organized was that grandparents lived with the family in the cave. And then when we were agricultural creatures, and right up until urbanization came. And the way we were structured is that both parents went out and hunted, and both parents then tilled the soil, and the grandmother stayed home and raised and took care of the babies. And then we had the Industrial Revolution, and this multi-generational family structure began to break up, and now we have the nuclear family. And what I think I've learned is that it's not natural. It's not natural for us grandparents, both grandmothers, not to be part of our grandchildren's lives. It's meant to be. And when we don't see our grandchildren for any length of time, like 3 hours, we begin to crave. We actually crave them. We physically crave them. So what I discovered in going into the science of grandparenting is that when we become grandmothers. Our brains are rewired. Mothers, when they give birth, actually, most of their brain is rewired, and they are infused with hormones and chemicals that make them vigilant, give them a strong sense of responsibility, and what they think is important is completely altered. Well, grandmothers, and grandfathers too, but they have a wholly separate system going on with them, but grandmothers, when we hold that baby, we too secrete hormones, particularly one called oxytocin, that is known as the bonding hormone, the bonding chemical. And when that happens, our brains are being rewired, and we are connected deeply to those babies. The first time I held my first grandchild, I had such a deep wallop of emotion, such an amazing, euphoric feeling that just completely captured my whole body. And I was not expecting this. I mean, everybody says being a grandparent's the best thing that can happen to a woman, but man, they don't tell you about that feeling that comes over you. It is a kind of loving that I don't think we ever have before. It's so different from the kind of love for our own children. As I said, a mother, particularly, and a father too, we are distracted in a way by this sense of responsibility. We are worried. We're worried until they go to college. I mean, we're actually worried beyond that. But a grandparent, we're not like that. Our loving is unencumbered, it's unconditional, and it's complete without any distraction. I know with my daughter, I have one child. I worked and raised her, and I spent so much time making lists that, you know, things that I was afraid I was going to forget to do. I mean, that I wasn't in the present almost ever. I was always worried about dropping the ball on something. Grandparents aren't like that. We are in the moment with those kids, 100%. And it feels great. It really feels good. It's such a wonderful chapter. And I think when we become grandparents, it's the unexpected new lease on life. So here's something else I discovered. When we're grandparents and our brains are rewired, something amazing happens besides just that loving feeling all through us. Here's what happens. No matter what kind of a parent we were, no matter how strict, no matter how critical, no matter how much we were on their case, you know, sit up straight, do your homework, come home early, call me, whatever it was, the minute we have a grandchild, like that, we flip from disciplinarian to mushball. Everything about that baby is perfect. We are truly, actually, no, I'm not exaggerating, I'm not being literary. We have fallen in love. And we've fallen in love in the sense that love is blind. Now, with my granddaughter, I knew she had three chins. I saw that. She was the most beautiful creature ever. And when they get a little older, you know, they make a blob on a piece of paper with a crayon, and you go, ah, an artist. They put the shoe on the right foot, a genius. We are so smitten. And the ability not to be indulgent, not to be permissive, it doesn't exist. We are grandma ice cream cone. We are grandma iPad. Now, the parent, the daughter or the daughter-in-law, has just said, no candy, no ice cream, no iPad, and they leave, and the kid says, can I have an iPad? And the answer is yes. Can I watch television? Yes. Can I see Frozen again? Yes. Because the very word no has been disabled. And grandfathers, they're worse. Here are these men who were CEOs or generals in the military, or you know, construction workers, whatever. Doctors, you know, the god at the hospital, whatever. And the grandchild's born, and they are having tea parties and playing with dolls. And they're on the floor, rolling around, giggling, and their little eyes are sparkling just like grandma's. We have this in common, men and women. We become hopeless, hopelessly besotted. And it happens almost physically. How can we all be the same in this permissiveness if it's not something completely biological, biochemical? It just is. Now, here's the thing. We have our ability to criticize completely disarmed. It's gone. However, we maintain our ability to criticize our kids. That doesn't go away. So there they are, raising our grandchildren. They're giving them tofu. And what we're saying is, oh, tofu, how nice. And they're doing the cloth diapers again. And we're saying, oh, cloth diapers, sure. Because we are so afraid of irritating them. We are so terrified, particularly the daughter-in-law. Shh, don't say anything. Because we know that the minute the baby's born, the balance of power in the family has shifted. I mean, instant shift. They have the power. They have the power to deny us access to those babies. So we had better be on our best behavior. And believe me, every grandparent I know is walking on eggshells, lest we get that look. And you know, the desire to criticize is still there. I mean, you're really having to sit on it big time. But we do, because all we want is those babies. And we'll do anything to have those babies. The saddest thing I came upon, and it took me 3 years to write this book, the saddest thing I came upon were grandparents who are not allowed to see their own grandchildren. And this is not an insignificant number of people. And some, maybe they get to see them once a year, not because they live across the country and can't afford to travel, but because their children don't want them there. This is just painful beyond belief, and I write a lot about it because I kept coming upon it. And what I say in the book is that we grandparents, we have to grovel. We have to grovel because you can't not be in your grandchild's life. They need us as much as we need them. It's just the way, it's biological. Both our children probably are having to work. They have to work to make as much money and maybe not even as much money as one breadwinner did when we were raising them. And they're both out there working. Child care is unbelievably expensive. In some cities, really good child care that you can trust, you can go to work and trust, can cost as much as college, really. So here we are, babysitters, totally free, who want to be there. And so we are more. When I say there's a new grandparenting, we're younger, or we think we're younger, or we're pretending to be younger, we certainly look younger. And we are in their lives more, if we are allowed to be. And here's what certainly is happening. We're spending more money on them than grandparents of any generation before us. This is a fact. Up until fairly recently, the middle age cohort made the money and took care of the older people in society. Today, It's the baby boomer generation and the generation ahead of them that has the money. So grandparents today, listen to this statistic that I came upon, unfortunately after I finished the book, but nevertheless. Grandparents today are spending 7 times more on their grandchildren than grandparents did just 10 years ago. And we're not just buying toys, which we are, of course. We're buying a lot of toys. But we're paying for their medical care. We're paying for their education. We're paying for daycare. We're buying big ticket items. We're buying the crib. We're buying the car seat. And I know at least one grandmother who bought them a piano. Now, I bought them one of those digital pianos, but my daughter would not practice the piano. And I am determined to have one person in my family who's going to play the piano. It's killing me. Someone I met along the way put it this way. He said, there are 3 stages of life. In the first stage, we believe in Santa Claus. In the second, we don't believe in Santa Claus. And in the third phase, we are Santa Claus. I like to say this is the age of the grandmother. It seems that people are more willing to accept an older woman in a position of authority than they are a young woman. Which brings us around to Granny Hillary, who, as you know, is battling some pretty hefty-sized negative ratings. Her unfavorables are only 11 points lower than Donald Trump's. So that's telling you that she has pretty high unfavorables. So about a year ago, I went to New Hampshire to sit in on a focus group. This was back in the day when Scott Walker was everybody's first choice among the Republicans. Marco Rubio was everybody's second choice. Chris Christie was coming up. Jeb Bush was everybody's last choice. This was a fact. So that's the era. And Trump was not anywhere on the radar screen. The guy who, the pollster who led the focus group, didn't even mention his name at all. So that was a little over a year ago. But I was there because I wanted to find out if Hillary being a grandmother would soften her image. So the man running the focus group, his name was Frank Luntz, and he's a Republican pollster. He asked the group for me, what one word comes to mind when I say grandmother? And out came these words: warm, hugs, wonderful, cozy, spoiling, happiness, and on like that. Not a single negative. So then I got up and I asked this group of self-described conservative Republicans, they all said they were conservative Republicans, if Hillary being a grandmother would make her more likable. And I was really surprised at how many, a sizable number of the group, said that they thought it would help as long as it didn't look as if she was exploiting the kid. In other words, she shouldn't walk around with the kid plastered to her hip or anything like that. But as short of that, they thought it would help. So I'm a little surprised that she doesn't talk about that little girl more. Now, I know she brings it up from time to time. I'm surprised she doesn't bring it up every chance she gets. And here's something else that surprised me, because back then, Marco Rubio, and I think Scott Walker as well, were working hard to make Hillary's age an issue. That's gone. Age is not an issue, because no matter who wins this election, there is going to be a grandparent in the White House. And Trump, for one, both Trump and Bernie Sanders are older than Hillary. So you haven't heard anything about age, and you probably won't hear anything about age in this campaign. So the reason that I wanted to write this book is that I wanted to find out what that initial emotion was in me. And was I alone? Or do all grandparents, all grandmothers, and then I looked into grandfathers, I'll tell you about them in a minute, whether we all have that. And virtually every grandmother I interviewed, not all, but almost all, said, yes, yes, I that's exactly what it was like for me. And yes, I am in love. What I discovered from a biochemist who studies the chemistry of the human body, was that the circuitry for baby love is the same circuitry for romantic love. It's the same pathways in our brains. We are literally, actually, truly falling in love. And grandparents often use the same language, love language, poet language. You know, I fell in love. All those delicious, wonderful, bliss words. And grandfathers, they go through it too. Grandfathers, I was told, seem to fall in love just a little bit later than grandmothers. They seem to have that eye contact, and they have to have something going back and forth. But little babies start to laugh when you make funny faces at them in about 2 weeks. So grandfathers kind of fall off the cliff in about 2 weeks. So here we are all walking around goofy, madly in love, and someone wise said to me, you know, if God had asked Abraham to sacrifice his grandson, he would have rolled his eyes and said, forget it, it's not going to happen. You know, I was one of those kind of tough moms. I wanted my daughter to be perfect, and I was a little bit on her case. And then, of course, I became this marshmallow with my grandchildren, and she looks at me and says, who are you, all of that? I'm sure your kids are doing the same with you. But my mother was perhaps the most flip-flop you ever saw. My mother was constantly, every minute of every day, on me, particularly after I started this career. She wanted this career. I don't want to say more than I did, but yeah, more than I did. She chose this. My mother was buying my clothes till I was 35 because she wanted me to look perfect on television. Every time she saw me on television, every time, I'd get the call, and I would just sit there shuddering because I knew I was going to be blasted for something. Can't you get a better haircut? Or where did you find that outfit? Constant. It was excruciating. So let me tell you a story about the early years with my mother in my career. CBS hired me right in 1972. Two things happened. Affirmative action had just come into force, so there you go. And about 2 weeks after they hired me, there was this burglary at the Watergate apartment complex. And nobody thought it was a story. They thought it was a local burglary. And nevertheless, it was at the Democratic Party headquarters, so they thought they better send someone. But because it was so insignificant, they sent the new girl. That was me. And I, from time to time, as the story developed over years, it would die. It would peak, and then it would die, and it would peak. The only other person in the courtroom, in the beginning, in the arraignment of the actual burglar, so day two, the only other person beside me in the courtroom was a reporter from the Washington Post, and his name was Bob Woodward. And we became friends, and he used to say to me, don't let them take the story away from you. Whatever happens, you cling to this story. Of course, great advice, because it was the biggest story for a reporter ever. And finally, as you, I can tell by the, because you raised your hands and said your grandparents, that you know that eventually the subject of Watergate was explored in Senate hearings. And in those days, the networks used to take something like that and put it on television. Now, today you wouldn't see that except on cable. But the three networks ran the Watergate hearings. And every night, CBS would run sort of a reprise of what had happened that day, about 20 minutes, and then 10 minutes of analysis. And there were different male reporters who would be sitting around the table to talk about what had happened that day, maybe the White House correspondent or the Senate or maybe the judiciary correspondent, but I was always there because they wanted to show that they were an equal opportunity employer because affirmative action was really popular back in the 70s. So I'm sitting there. And don't forget, my mother's watching. And the men are not letting me talk. They're arguing with each other, and I'm trying to get a word in. Don't you think? Well, I disagree. They didn't let me talk. I mean, night after night after night, I would come in with volumes of notes and thoughts, and I was never talked. So, I don't know, a week goes by like that, and the boss calls us in and says, you know, we're getting swamped with mail, telegrams. You know, this was pre-email. The public thinks that you guys are being rude to Leslie. And, you know, if you don't let her talk, we're just not going to do this anymore. So that night, we all knew I was going to talk, and I was ready. The first question, we had a moderator, and his question was something along the lines of, well, what's the gossip in Washington about John Ehrlichman? John Ehrlichman was Nixon's right-hand man. I hear the word gossip. I have a guy on each side. And I say to myself, you know, kid, why don't you let them gossip? And you'll answer the next question. So I sat there. They have been read the Riot Act. They have to let me talk. So they sit there. So there's nothing going on. Dead silence. It's excruciating. Daniel Shore, you all remember him. He jumps into this vacuum and says something along these lines. Well, you asked for gossip. Well, we have a woman here. I'm not making this up. I forget what I'm supposed to gossip about because I'm so angry and annoyed and filled with all these emotions. So I start to talk. Believe me, no sense came out of this mouth. Nothing. No parsing, no logic, no John Ehrlichman. Thank God I didn't even end at a sentence. I was going to say the sentence ended. I stopped in the middle of a sentence, and that was that. Show ends. I ran upstairs, and I called home. And I said, Daddy, because my father answered the phone, Daddy, you have to help me write a letter of resignation. I can never be seen anywhere in the world because this was on national television. I'm going to have to move to Canada like everybody else is talking about moving to Canada now. I'm going to move. Maybe I'll move. I don't know. Where don't they have television? And he said to me, you were great. What are you talking about? So smart, so clever. Dad, I was a disaster. I was a total disaster. And if you cannot be honest with me, put Mother on the phone. And my father said, Mother can't talk right now. She's too upset. That woman turned into a mushball with my daughter. I mean, I couldn't believe what was happening. So to me, that is the real evidence that something happens within us. We don't say, you know, anything the kid wants, we're going to be indulgent or permissive. We don't say that. It happens. And it happens to all of us. And it's a little miracle. It's a little miracle. Okay, I'm moving ahead here. So I want to get back for 1 minute to this idea that there are grandparents who do not see their own children. There are some states, I don't know actually about Michigan, but there are some states in the United States, quite a few, where grandparents can actually go to court and sue for visitation rights. But if they do and they win, they can only see their grandchildren with a social worker in the room. Now, just think about that, and think what kind of message that sends to the grandchildren about your trustworthiness. I mean, this is all a terrible thing to me. The main reason it's terrible is because grandparents provide something necessary for little kids. They get our unconditional love. And children need to know that they're lovable. And their parents are going to be on their case. That's our job. Our job is to tell them they're wonderful and perfect. That's what we're supposed to do. And grandfathers, their job is to tell them about the history of the family, to give them a sense that it's not just this tiny little nuclear family, you're part of something larger. And you know, they have found that it's easier for a little kid to talk to his or her grandparents than it is their own parents. And somebody did a study of Facebook and found that children like their grandparents more often than they like their own parents. So, you know, there's just an innate, obvious connection. And as I said before, it is unnatural for us not to be in their lives. When we do take care of our children, when we are allowed to take care of our grandchildren, we get stronger. Holding a baby who is your baby's baby is life-affirming. And we see our children doing a great job in raising our grandchildren. I can't get over how attentive my daughter and her husband are to my little girls. I have two little girls. I think my generation, our generation, if we worked, if the mother worked, that we didn't get the balance right. We were really struggling to get into the workplace. They call us the pioneers. We were the first women into the white-collar workplace. And we had to fight our way in. And we wanted to prove that we could do the jobs as well as the men. And sometimes we thought that the way to prove that was to be like the men. So for instance, men didn't breastfeed, we didn't breastfeed. I remember when my daughter said she was going to breastfeed and I almost fell over. But they're all breastfeeding now. And you know, working mothers, when I started working, we didn't. I think they're doing a better job than we did. So even though I think we're being critical because we can't help ourselves, I at least admire what's happening right now. So holding a baby, as I said, who's your baby's baby, is life-affirming. A grandparent can crawl into a vat of joy when they're with their grandchildren. And here is the most wonderful thing of all, the most wonderful thing. We love them unconditionally. They love us, also unconditionally. So that's my talk, except, and I know there are microphones for you to ask me questions. You can ask me questions about anything. I mean, about 60 or anything you want. So I invite you to come down to the microphones, and as you come down, oh good, light's coming up. Now I can see you. If you want to ask questions, but while you're coming down, I'm going to tell you that one of the things I did as I went around the country working on this book and interviewing grandparents, I collected grandfather jokes. So before anybody asks me a question, I'm going to tell you one of the grandfather jokes that I heard. Don't be offended, guys, okay? So this guy was going to have his 80th birthday, and he was freaking out. He was just beside himself, turning the big 8-0. So his friends got together and they said, you know, we have to do something nice for Mel. You know, we have to just kind of ease his way here. So his birthday comes and his doorbell rings. He opens the door and there is this young, gorgeous, voluptuous young woman. And she says, "Hi, Mel. I'm Susie, and your friend sent me to give you super sex. And Mel, after he can't get over what he's saying, looks down, looks up, and he says, I'll take the soup. Pretty good. Okay, come and ask me questions.
Hi, my name is Claire Dahl, and I have a million questions for you, but I'm going to keep it on topic.
Good.
Okay.
And you can ask me anything.
No, really. That's right. I share two granddaughters with you, which I think is awesome, wonderful, and I agree with everything you've said. But I'm wondering if you interviewed any grandparents who have taken on the monumental task of raising their grandchildren full-time, and whether or not the wiring that you talked about in terms of the mothering and the grandmothering have literally kind of mixed up and is just making that job even harder and more physically exhausting than I think it probably is.
Yes, the question is, did I find and do I write about what's called custodial grandparents? I write a lot about it. There's a whole chapter on it. And these are grandparents who, for never a good reason, gain custody. It could be that their children are in jail, drug addicts. The children may have been taken away because of neglect, or the parents die. So it's never a good reason. And the grandparents, who may have had all kinds of plans for their retirement, traveling, playing golf, are now back at the beginning raising a child. And very often, it starts out with great resentment, exhaustion. It is an unbelievably hard job for a person whose mind wasn't there. It's not like having a baby, you know, with all that excitement. But what I found was that the joy comes in, the joy of seeing, raising a kid. It just returns. On the permissive sort of disciplinarian scale, they are not permissive. They take on the parent role. And all that suggests, they're responsible. They take on the worry. They take on the sit up straight and eat your vegetable role. I write about a house, it's called the House in the Bronx. I write about this building that the city of New York put up. As far as I know, it's the only building of its kind in the country. It should be in every city. It's a building just for grandmothers and great-grandmothers who are raising their kids. I mean, it's actually for grandparents. It's called the Grandparent Building, but they're virtually all widows, and they're all struggling to take care of these kids. The city of New York provides them with all kinds of counseling. They're given lessons on how to talk to a teenager who wants to know why his parents rejected him. They're taught how to deal with anger as the kids get older and realize that they've been rejected in some way, or they feel they've been rejected. There's all kinds of tutoring for the kids. I mean, this is an amazing building, but there's only 50 apartments. And it's beautiful, by the way, and they have 24-hour security, which they need because this building is in one of the worst high crime areas in the entire city of New York, in the Bronx. So that's a special place. It turned out, and I didn't even know this when I started writing my book, that my sister-in-law, who's a psychologist and runs a clinic for abused children, has as her private patients, not part of the clinic, a whole bunch of grandparents who are raising children on their own. And she tells me that they come to her with these seething resentments and how what she does to try to thread them out of that. And one of the things she told me, which I love, put in the book, of course, was a grandfather who was the most enraged about this situation to get a balloon and toss a balloon back and forth with his little 4-year-old granddaughter. And pretty soon he was laughing. Pretty soon she was laughing. Pretty soon he was laughing more than she was laughing. And then my sister-in-law said, when you do that, I want you to look into her eyes and make eye contact and stay with her and let her know that you love her and just stay there. And pretty soon they thread out of it. But yeah, I mean, your question was really about the discipline permissive, and those grandparents take on the whole coloration of parents. And even, I have a friend I write about. She's a real friend. It wasn't someone I came upon. And her daughter, single, had to work to raise her twins. And my friend was a very, was a president of a college. She had a big time job. She retired from that, but she was going on to her second career. And her daughter said, "Mom, I can't do it." So she moved to live not in the house, but near. And she has the kids 5 days a week. She has not custody because she has to walk on eggshells around her daughter. But this is what she told me is so interesting. She's the disciplinarian because she has the responsibility for getting the kids in shape. And her daughter comes home from work and she's the permissive one. Well, you can see why, you know. Whoever, I don't know, you can understand that the mother had turned the responsibility over and she wanted her children to love her. I felt I was actually kind of permissive too because I wasn't there very much. And I would come home and, you know, do whatever she wanted in a way. So I understand that. But there are a lot of custodial grandparents among us. And my sister-in-law calls them the unsung heroes because we don't know how difficult it is for them. I also wrote about a community in Illinois called Hope Meadows. And this was a planned community. Well, let me tell you the story, because you're not asking me questions, so I'm going to tell you this great story. There was this woman who was doing her PhD thesis on the foster care system in Illinois. And she just became so upset at how families would take a kid and reject a kid. They'd raise the kid or they'd have the kid in the house for a year and then say, "I can't deal with it anymore," and send him back. And she was watching this in her research and she couldn't stand it. She said, "I have to do something." And she decided that if these families lived together in a compound or a neighborhood, that when it got too much, the families would come together and support each other and help get over that hump. So she decided she was going to stage an experiment and bring together 12 families that would not take in foster kids but would adopt siblings. She got 12 families, some single women, but mainly families, to take sometimes 3, sometimes 4, very troubled foster kids, adopt them. She found a closing Air Force base, Rantoul Air Force Base, and called the Pentagon and said, "I need 12 of those gorgeous houses on this Air Force base. You're closing it. I need those 12 houses." She found this gorgeous kind of officer's neighborhood that looks exactly like a beautiful suburb. And she said, "Can I have 12? And they said, "No, the Pentagon, you're dealing with the Pentagon. The bureaucracy, are you kidding? We can't give someone 12 houses." And she just nagged them. She made 1,000 phone calls to get this woman out of their hair. They said, "Okay, you can have a subdivision. We can't do 12, but just take a subdivision. 88 houses. I mean, these are spectacular houses. It looks like the best suburb you've ever seen. Gorgeous lawns, trees." So now she has 12 families and 88 houses. By the way, they gave her 88 houses for $250,000. So how could she say no, right? So she raised money, she got the money, she gets this community. Now she has 70 houses that nobody in them. So she puts an ad in various newspapers around the country for senior citizens, retirees. "If you want to move out of your big house, come and live here, subsidized rent, very nice housing, and just live here. And what she thought was, we can't have empty houses. I just have to fill up the houses. And senior citizens, you know, we won't have any trouble. So they came. They came and filled up the houses. And here's what happened. Organically, no plan. This woman never foresaw this, never wanted it to happen, never thought about it. The senior citizens start becoming grandparents. The kids, they discovered, needed to come to them. They couldn't pick out Johnny and say, I want to be your grandmother. They just waited for Johnny to pick out who they wanted. And they began to call them Grandma and Grandpa. Now, all the kids, not all, but virtually 99% of the kids were Black and Hispanic, and 99% of the seniors and the parents were white, Caucasian. And there was, I mean, within no time, there were no colors. There were grandparents and children, like all grandparents and children. And the loving became as much as I love my child, that like that, the emotion, the caring. There was one story that just, gosh, all the stories were great. All the stories were about people coming frail and infirm, and within 3 months being hale and hearty. They had a purpose. They had a real purpose to get up in the morning and help these kids, play with them, teach them things. There were these two men. One had been very sickly. He wasn't sick anymore. I mean, he just was cured. It was unbelievable. And his friend, George. And there was a kid. I forget his name. Let's call him Alexander. I think that was it. Alexander. He was a violent kid. He was thrown out of virtually every school he ever went to. And these people had adopted him with his brothers and sisters, but he was the troubled kid who was creating problems for everybody. And the two senior grandfathers decide they're going to go to school with this kid every day. And they took turns. And they went to school with Alexander. They rode on the bus with him. They sat next to him. In every class, they sat next to him in the cafeteria, and the grandfathers just calmed him down. And if there was ever, as they felt him rising up, they'd put their hand on him, and he would just calm down. And they got Alexander through school. I mean, stunning stories like that, just fabulous. And it's called Hope Meadows. And unlike the building in the Bronx, they are building houses like this around the country. I mean, building communities like this around the country. So it's nice. They're building one for troubled veterans. So they're going to have families adopt, and then they're going to fill the houses with veterans who have PTSD to see if the children can help them, which they will. It's inevitable. A question.
Hi, Leslie. You alluded to tofu and as a permissive thing that you'd be willing to ignore. The whole area of how to feed a grandchild. Nowadays, that's got to be a real landmine for grandparents because many parents that have really strong ideas about nutrition and about dangers of food, peanuts, and everything else that goes into feeding their child. So just in terms of, even if you're going to be completely willing to obey all of your own children's rules with their children, it must be extremely complicated to figure out what to do right. So what are your thoughts about that?
Okay, did you hear that? It's about the tofu and the food and what, well, you know, for me, as a working mother in the 70s, everything was out of a jar. Everything was out of a jar. And the most important thing was to make it fast. Because we had to get home, we wanted to feed him, put it in the microwave, or whatever we did in those days. And yeah, I roll my eyes. But I, as I said before, I think my daughter, you know, she's pureeing fresh vegetables, and I'm rolling my eyes, but she's right. She's right. I know that she's right. I don't think I was a very good mother, you know. My husband, the truth is, my husband was the great parent. So I look at my daughter and the way she's doing it, and I say, oh my God, oh my God. She's, you know, everything's fresh. Is she kidding? But she's doing it. And I'm sure it's better. Although I look at her and I say, you know, you turned out okay, kiddo. You didn't do that bad a job. But here's the other thing. My daughter's a working mother, and she started out determined that everything was going to be fresh and pureed and all of that. And then she, and no iPad. And now we take them to the restaurant, and to keep them quiet, they have the iPad, and she'll give them spaghetti every night for 3 nights in a row. I mean, you know, it happens. You're harried, and it just oozes out the need to make it all come together. Working mothers still have a difficult time. Working fathers as well. Working parents still have a hard time doing the balancing act. But I do, as I said before, I'm convinced that they're doing it better. So I may have a little thought in the back of my mind, what is she doing? But I don't say anything.
Hi, Leslie. Thank you for the talk, and I'm really excited about the book. So I'm wondering if you talk to many grandparents like me whose grandkids live far away. I mean, thank goodness for Skype and FaceTime.
Yes.
But we don't get to be as helpful it's painful to know that, like what you said, they love us as much as we love them, and then our kids need us to be more helpful. And it's a balance. I'm just wondering what you're hearing from other grandparents, because it's really hard, and I'm lucky. I see her. The longest was 12 weeks,
ooh.
California, and generally it's 6 to 8 weeks. My kids are very generous with either calling for me or bringing her here, but it's hard. Really hard.
You know, I told you that when people retire, this is not an insignificant movement in this country, that when they retire, when both retire, they're picking up and moving there. But it is hard. I live across the country from my grandchildren, and it's painful. It's very painful. Thank goodness for FaceTime and Skyping, because they can see us. We can actually watch each other. We can see what they're doing. I don't know about your kids, but my kids put the camera wherever it is and just let us watch them run around.
Yeah, run around and sing Frozen.
And see Frozen.
Yes.
So that's funny you mentioned Frozen,
because
I don't know if you've seen the book yet, but there's this wonderful picture on the cover, and the book publisher sent the photographer to have a picture of me holding the two girls reading. And they'd always loved to be read to. They love it. Except this day. So if Jordan, the older one, was cooperating and watching me read the book, the other one wasn't, and vice versa. So eventually, it was so unbelievably frustrating, eventually we taped an iPhone into the book and put on Frozen. And that's what you're seeing. Those little girls look like they're reading the book. Forget that. You're laughing because you know. Here's another thing that happens when you have a grandchild. You have to decide what you're going to be called. Now, this is a project. I mean, I've been out on the book tour, and I've been signing books, and most are Grandma and Grandpa. But then there's Mimi and Peepaw and Poop, I don't know. So I wanted to be Granny. I wanted to be a grandmother. I wanted to be a grandmother from the age of 45. And I do think that there's a grandmother biological clock. I mean, you know, you have a clock in your early 30s. If you don't have a kid yet, you start to really want a kid. Well, grandmothers have it, and it comes at a different age for all of us, and I was 45. And I was driving my kid nuts, and she was 10. I mean, this was a horrible thing. So I wanted to be Granny. My daughter informed me that I was not going to be Granny. She was not going to have it. Now, my mother, Miss the Tuffy, her real name was Dolly, and she wanted her grandchildren to call her Dolly. And we did, and that was that. So I thought, well, if I tried to get them to say Leslie, how would it come out? So I decided it would come out Lolly. So I announced that I was going to be Lolly. And my husband said, okay, then I'm going to be Pop. And we're going to be Lollipop. And we are. And they can say that. But here's the thing. They didn't get it. You know, they were so young. They've been calling us Lolly and Pop from the minute they were born. And they didn't get it. They didn't get it. And all of a sudden, when my older one turned 4, she got it. And I was there the day she got it. You know, Lollipop, Lollipop. You know, so great. It's just wonderful. So people have asked me, what's it like for them to see you on television? Well, that's the other thing. They have never not seen me on television. So they don't think it's anything. They think you're all on television. They don't know that. They think that's what grandparents do, or grandmothers anyway. So that means nothing to them. But I have become a hero to my older granddaughter. And here's how it happened. She said to me, and very recently, she called me on the phone, or on FaceTime, actually. And she said, Lolly, is it true that you know Taylor Swift? And I did a story on Taylor Swift. When I said yes, my God, now, at last, I'm a hero to my granddaughter. That's all it took.
Hi, Leslie. My wife and I are big-time fans of 60 Minutes. And I have to also say we're fans of football. And we're always disappointed when football runs past the 7 o'clock hour.
I know.
Eastern
Tell
time.
Me about it. Right. Well, go ahead.
So, questions in your research. Have you come across biological grandparents that did not have a connection to their grandkids? And conversely, step-parents that did have this connection?
Perfect question. Have I come upon grandparents who did not have this connection, and have I met step-grandparents who did? So let me answer the second one first. One of the reasons that I wanted to write this book was because I have 4 very, very close girlfriends. I'm in a ladies' lunch group, 4 in the group, who are step-grandmothers and who are exactly like me. They fell off the cliff, hopelessly in love with the baby. Now, those are women who were there as a step-grandmother from the beginning. I also know of cases where it was a little difficult if the kids were older. But when it's a baby, the step-grandmother and grandfather, same thing, it doesn't matter, grandmother, grandfather, go through exactly what the biological mother does. And, you know, there's a lot of looking at your own kid and saying, my kid had that baby. My kid is raising that baby. But in the end, I thought that was a small part of it. It's that biological connection. And a step-grandparent absolutely has it. Now, did I run across grandparents who did not feel that? I ran across a couple of grandmothers who say, I raised a bunch of kids. I've done that. I'm not going to do it again. I mean, I've done that in my life. Doesn't mean they aren't crazy about the grandchildren. They love the grandchildren. They just don't want to babysit. They've done it. But I came upon very few. And there's always exceptions to the rule. But yes, of course. There's a whole name now called Glamma. Glamma, you know, is having a pedicure, and she's not going to babysit, and that's an example of that. But really, most are people who love those babies so much that they miss them all the time. I used to get into bed, I still do a little bit, but in the beginning, and I would fantasize that I was holding my baby. I call her my baby. My baby in my arms. You know, that's like a lover almost. It really is. It's that wonderful in a way. Okay. More questions? I was going to say, if no more questions, we'll go out and do some book signing.
Okay. So I'll ask you one last question.
Okay. Make it kind. I say that as a 60 Minutes correspondent. I don't know what I'm thinking.
No, thank you very much for this, because also as a relatively new grandmother, I feel the same way. But I have a question for you personally about your work with 60 Minutes. You've alluded in your talk to whether or not you felt you were a good mother at times and all of that, and you're still working, and you're still mostly in a male-dominated, it's changing, but you're still one of the only women on 60 Minutes. Lara Logan,
we'll talk about
perhaps.
That in a minute.
Okay. But so I'm just curious about, when do you see yourself winding down so you can spend more time with your grandchildren? Is this what you plan to do with your time? Is, you know, are you going to keep working? Are you going to, how are you going to balance that? It's a different balance than when you were a mother. How are you going to balance it now that you're a grandmother?
Right. Well, first of all, that's a two-part question. The in the men's world kind of thing. You know, at 60 Minutes, almost half, and it, sometimes it goes up and down, the producers are women. So when I go to work, it doesn't feel like a male enclave. I know the correspondents have been, certainly when I got there, I was the only woman, but I mean, there have been a lot of other women reporters now on 60 Minutes, and the environment is kind of equal. Journalism has always been friendlier to women than other professions. And women do pretty well in journalism. And if you look at watch television today in terms of broadcast journalism, or even read the newspapers, you're going to see an awful lot of women's names. When I got there, honestly, the men, they welcomed me. I was brought into the club. I never had a problem. Mike Wallace brought me there. I had already known Morley before. By the way, I don't know how many of you saw the special we did Sunday night, because he's just retired. It was really good, right? Anyway, I never felt that I wasn't one of the group, and they were lovely to me. And it's always been that way. And 60 Minutes is it's a wonderful place to work. I love it. I've always loved it. And I haven't retired because I still love what I do, and they haven't told me to leave yet. So I'm sure they will one day. And you know, I had a conversation with my boss the other day, and I said to him, if I start to fail, like I feel I'm not as sharp, I'm going to come and tell you. And he said, no, you're not. No one ever does that. He said, but I'll tell you. So the sword is over my head. So thank you for coming. I appreciate it.